This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. It's good to have you listening today. Around the turn of the 21st century, some thought Milwaukee's near north side was on the verge of a revival. Many political and business leaders believed there were too many people living in the area for it to struggle indefinitely, and that market forces would be instrumental in bringing the community back.
Flash forward to 2014, and much of that area is still beset by struggle. The 53206 zip code in particular remains the most impoverished in the city. In fact, every economic indicator in a new study of the neighborhood shows things have gotten worse since the beginning of the millennium.
Mark Levine is professor of history, economic development, and urban studies at UW-Milwaukee and the author of the study. He explained why there was an assumption that the region would recover and where he believes that assumption was flawed.
There was this notion that there were certain competitive advantages in geographic location and in the density of the population in the zip code that could be the springboard to economic development. And certainly location is a factor, but it has to be combined with other initiatives that would maximize that locational advantage and link it to other kind of regional development issues. And I think the city kind of dropped the ball on that in some of the other policy interventions that might have raise the economic profile of the neighborhood. The other supposition, though, that the density of the population, irregardless of the poverty in the neighborhood, would be potentially the springboard for retail development was fallacious from the start. This notion that somehow there was all this hidden purchasing power, and if myths were undermined about the limits of economic development in the neighborhood, and if the retail community just understood how much buying power there was in the neighborhood, irrespective of the fact that 20% of the households in the neighborhood earned under $10,000 a year, you know, all of those millions of dollars would essentially lead to economic development. Well, a couple of things. Number one, that aggregate income actually has declined and has been continuously declining in that area for 40 years in Milwaukee, but it declined by another 20% or so in the last decade. So whatever competitive advantage of that purchasing power has existed has been eroding over the years. But secondly, the notion that somehow aggregate purchasing power would be the fulcrum of economic development is flawed on the face of it. People don't buy in the aggregate. I mean, it's like Bill Gates and I combined are worth about $80 billion. He's worth 79.999. I'm worth less. So our buying is not going to – you can say, well, God, the two of them have $80 billion of aggregate purchasing power. We don't purchase that way. And so obviously the community doesn't get together and decide, okay, as a community, let's buy a couch. Let's buy groceries. Let's buy anything else. People consume as individual households, and so when household income is low, that obviously is an impediment to any kind of consumer-driven revival.
And in that last decade, you were saying the city kind of dropped the ball or those who had a chance to positively impact this. Was there one kind of catalyzing force? Was there one place it could have started that might have made the difference?
No, I don't think so. I think it really does require a long-term kind of strategic perspective that's different than the one that we've been taking. The strategic perspective I think that we've been taking has essentially been this market-driven approach as opposed to important strategic public investments, links to regional economic development strategies, transportation investments, for example, that might link workers in or potential workers in 53206 to jobs where they're actually growing in the community. Ways of encouraging some of the employers in areas, for example, that complain that they can't find workers to come into 53206 and locate their establishments there.
And this is one of the counterintuitive things that you found, I think, for people who have sort of a fundamental understanding of cities, that the people who live in 53206, which is an urban zip code, have
there.
The longest commutes of anybody in the metro area.
Exactly. 16% have commutes over 45 minutes. We seem to have this notion that the long commutes are people from, let's say, Waukesha driving into Milwaukee and whatever. And certainly that's an element of life out in exurbia. But the longest commutes are for folks in zip codes like 53206, the majority of whom have to take, or a large number in any event, have to take public transportation to get to to get to their jobs. If you're taking public transportation to a suburban location, that's going to be a long trip. And consequently, you have that as a barrier to employment. You have the barrier of employment, of transportation being difficult and long. You have the barrier that we don't deal with in this report, but it's certainly you've talked about it for a year now, or more or less, the barrier, obviously, of mass incarceration. And 53206, the data is a little squishy on this, but I think it's fair to say 53206 is the epicenter, once again, of the mass incarceration epidemic in Milwaukee. We know how much of a barrier to employment incarceration is, or a history of incarceration is on someone's record. So it's no accident that barely over a third of the men in the working age men in 53206 are in fact working now. Long trips, jobs not in the neighborhood. Only 2%, I think, of workers of residents in 53206 actually work in 53206. The vast majority do work in the city of Milwaukee, but some do work in the suburbs, and it's, as we've been talking about, a real problem in terms of transportation.
For all the talk about the imminent and diverse economic developments, and this might eventually have us transitioning to the other report you recently wrote, but what sectors in 53206 have ended up driving the employment picture to the degree that it exists there?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and it's one that I think is really quite revealing, and that is that. Let me just put a little historical perspective on this. If we go back to the 1970s and even into the early 1980s, in the neighborhoods in and around 53206, there was still a fairly large number of family-supporting jobs in those areas. About a third of the workforce, of the employed workers in areas like 53206, worked in manufacturing. So you had A.O. Smith, which employed 10, 12,000 people. You had the American Motors plant. You had a lot of smaller manufacturing shops along Capitol Drive and in the Capitol Drive area right on the border and into 53206. Well, today it's down to about 10%. So it's declined precipitously, and in its place has essentially arisen to a much greater extent than the city of Milwaukee as a whole and certainly the metro area, in an economy built on health care services and social assistance. Over two-fifths of the jobs that are in 53206 are in health care and social assistance. The fastest growing business establishments, or as the Census Bureau defines them, establishments, are in child care services, daycare services.
Right. I think more than a fifth of all businesses in that zip code are child care centers.
And that's actually slightly down from a few years ago. I think the subsidies that obviously were part of W-2 and other reforms led to a peaking of about a third, almost 31% of all of the business establishments in 53206 being child care services. That's a huge increase from 1994 when only 5% were. So you go from 5% to 31%. Now we're down to about a fifth, which is still an extraordinary number. And so those are jobs that don't pay very well. They should pay better. There are ways to make them pay better. There are countries that have higher paid workers in child care services than we do. But the fact of the matter is that the child care services and many of the health care and social assistance services are part of the low-wage sector. So you're not going to have family-supporting jobs coming out of those sectors where, in fact, there has been some employment growth and business growth in 53206.
Well, and this dovetails nicely into the other report you recently authored, which looks at employment growth in Wisconsin. And employment growth has happened, but you write it has happened in exactly these kinds of sectors.
Right. We've had a proliferation of essentially low-wage employment in Wisconsin over the last, again, decade. The study covers the period from 2000 to 2013, the most recent data that we have available on the wage levels in occupations. And we found sort of three main periods, the 2000 to 2007 period in which there was what's called the U-shaped or polarized development, job growth at the bottom, job growth at the top, and a shrinkage of jobs in the middle. 2007 to 2010, during the Great Recession, we lost jobs in all wage categories. But since 2010, during the recovery period, we've had what one economist calls a downward ramp. The huge decline in the middle, about 121,000 jobs lost in the middle category. And I should clarify here, we define the middle category as jobs paying between $12.50 and $25 an hour. So in annualized rates, it's about $26,000 to $52,000 a year. And there's a huge decline in that area, a slight decline since 2010 in the high wage category, and essentially all of the growth, 130,000 jobs since 2010 in the low wage category, and most of those in what I call the very low wage category. That is jobs paying under $10 an hour. And these are jobs generally in food services, personal care, residential and home health care, and retail sales.
Well, and so maybe this is an obvious point, but what does a picture like that do to the other sectors of the economy?
I think it's problematic in a couple of ways. One is that obviously, as we were talking about with respect to 53206, when you have a large number of people from particular neighborhoods working in these low-wage jobs, if they're working at all, that obviously undercuts economic development in their area because there's simply not enough consumer demand in their area because incomes are so low. And I think the second point is that for an economy as a whole, that proliferation of low-wage jobs also exerts an inhibiting effect on overall economic development. Consumer spending is between 65 and 70% of the economy in the nation and in any individual state. So if you have a contraction in the wages that are being paid, and we know that real income has been stagnant for many decades. It's declined in the state of Wisconsin and in the Milwaukee area precipitously since 2000, and it's continued to decline even during the recovery since 2010. So it's we clearly have other evidence about the decline in wages. Well, if you have the proliferation of low wage jobs, if you have people who are earning lower wages, they're going to have less money to spend. People are going to be less likely to start a business because they see demand out there or the possibility of making a profit. And so it all, has an inhibiting effect on job growth, which I think is one of the reasons why, and this was, I know, a big issue in the gubernatorial campaign, why job growth in Wisconsin has been so sluggish over the last decade, but in particular in the 3 years of the recovery where job growth has begun to pick up a lot elsewhere, but not so much here.
Well, and so maybe this is a naive question, but if so much of this equation is dependent on consumer demand for driving economic recovery, why isn't it that the companies that are in the business of making things aren't typically raising wages faster so that more people can afford to buy their stuff?
Yeah, well, that's the billion-dollar question. I mean, it's Henry Ford, of course, was among business people one of the first to make that observation. So much so that the whole system became known as Fordism: pay your workers a living wage, and then they can buy your product. You can sell those Model Ts to your workers themselves. You would think that would be a sort of general understanding, but at the aggregate level of looking at the economy, certainly economic policymakers ought to understand that. Anybody with any kind of Keynesian background ought to understand that. For any one individual business owner, in the same way that for any one individual household during tough economic times, you want to tighten your belt and you stop spending. And that's fine for any individual household. You don't want to go bankrupt. If we all do it, then the economy grinds to a halt because nobody's spending anything. Well, I think the same thing applies for any individual business. For any individual business owner, it makes sense to try to get workers for the lowest possible wage because you want to maximize your individual profits. Well, if all business owners do that, you end up with an increasingly impoverished or increasingly low-wage workforce, and that in turn ultimately will inhibit future business growth. So in some ways, the premise of your question, I think, is exactly right on. And that is that if as a class business owners could take a longer term perspective on these issues and understand that raising the minimum wage makes sense, that paying workers a living wage ultimately makes sense, even if in the short run their profit margin might be somewhat compromised, I think overall the economy would be in much better shape.
Mark Levine, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Mitch. Thank you.
Mark Levine is professor of history, economic development, and urban studies, and senior fellow and founding director at the Center for Economic Development at UW-Milwaukee. He's author of two recent reports, the latest of which is called Zip Code 53206, a statistical snapshot of the inner city distress in Milwaukee 2000 to 2012.
We'll take a quick break now and then speak with Canadian author Miriam Taves about the award-winning novel based on her sister's suicide. This is Lake Effect on WUWM.